So, without further ado, we're going to start a new period here, because it's that time of the month. It's a period of increased persecution. All right? 249 to 313. All right? So the last part of the 3rd century, first part of the 4th century. And I'm calling it the period of increased persecution is because this, well, it's kind of self-explanatory, but the state is going to make a concerted effort to hurt the Christians as much as they can. And I'm going to talk about the reasons for that in a minute, but that's why we call it this. There's a popular misconception about Christian history that sees the church locked in this continuous struggle against the state for the first 300 years of its existence, where there's this wave after wave of relentless state-inspired persecution. The myth portrays this continual bloodbath where numberless Christians are exterminated, all of them dying bravely for their faith. And you see all the courage that they display as they're faced with death. And before you know it, because everyone's just so impressed with how they face up to this persecution, the Roman Empire just gives up and decides to convert to Christianity. Well, that's not exactly what happens, okay? Over against that popular misunderstanding, we have the reality. And the reality is that persecution, up until this period, right, we're talking about right now, up until this period, persecution was typically local rather than empire-wide. The reason why it was local is because much of it was the result not of a state policy, but of mob persecution, mob pressure, let's put it that way, on the governors, on the local governors, to do something about these Christians. So it just depends on what the state of mind of the people in a certain area is. The death of Jesus himself, that story, that shows you how the mentality of a mob can result in persecution, right? The martyrdom of Polycarp that you read also shows how the governor meekly follows the will of the mob. And likewise, mob violence was the trigger for persecution in Gaul in 177. Eusebius talks about that period of persecution too. So it just crops up when the people rise up and ask for it. So it's inappropriate to characterize the reigns of Roman emperors throughout these first few centuries and say, oh, he was a persecuting emperor. Oh, he was a nice emperor. That doesn't really go, because the emperor really didn't have a whole lot to do with it. Now, we saw that one instance where Pliny was writing to the Emperor Trajan as to what to do, but again, it shows how it's really the local governor who is at the forefront of this. The emperor, he doesn't have a whole lot to do with it until this period. And actually, the demands of other concerns commonly made governors not want to respond to the mob pressure against Christians. The governors didn't have a whole lot of staff, so they couldn't handle a lot of different cases at the same time. You just got to, you know, prioritize here. And that wasn't a big priority. Governors would visit major towns of their province maybe once a year. And it was during those visits that Christians would need to be arraigned for trial. But often a whole bunch of other concerns were presented to the governor at that time, a whole year's worth of them. And he might not have gotten to the Christian thing because it wasn't really at the top of the agenda. For long periods, we have almost no persecution at all. For example, the period between 260 and 303, which is actually in this period I have here, there wasn't a whole lot of persecution. There's going to be a lot at the beginning and a lot at the end. Also, persecution might occur in one area but not another. So one, you know, you might live in a certain town where no one ever bothers you for being a Christian. So keep that in mind. Also, contrary to some popular myths, Christians were not uniformly heroic in facing persecution. Many were, But at times, there were those who compromised their faith in the face of death. For example, in 250 CE, during the Decian persecution, which I'm going to talk about in a second, Decius decreed that all free citizens had to sacrifice to the gods of the empire, and Christians crumpled under the threat of death by the thousands. All right? A North African bishop, commenting on this, said that the number of Christians willing to sacrifice to the gods was so great at that time that the officials had to ask many of them to come back the next day in order to be processed. Right? So that they're lining up to sacrifice so they could be saved from death. Now, two obvious questions come up. First of all, why did the state decide to persecute suddenly as a state policy beginning in 249? And why were some Christians so eager to die? Because we're going to find some of them welcoming this. Why is that? All right, let's first talk about the number one question. Why did the state persecute? The rationale for persecuting Christians. I already stressed to you the role of the mob in the persecuting process, with very small upper classes and even very small middle classes in ancient Rome. Most of the populace were very, very poor. They're at the bottom of the totem pole. And everyone desires to have some kind of esteem, to be a little more important than somebody else. So what do? You look for others who are worse than you, or try to make somebody lower than you. So nobodies of the Roman rabble could feel like somebodies by identifying some other underdogs and kicking them. And so Christians provided a convenient target. Makes them feel better, these lower classes. That was why the mob wanted to go after him. The divisive influence of Christianity also could be seen within families. There was this scapegoating passion at the time. There seems to have been more women who were converts to Christianity than men during this period. And conversions within a larger family unit could easily drive a wedge into domestic relationships, especially like between husband and wife. So, for example, a story narrated by Justin Martyr, now this is from earlier, but it highlights this aspect of persecution. He says that there was a wife of a resident of Rome. She converted to Christianity. Now, this husband was a real louse, and he led a very debauched life. He was cheating on her and everything, and she divorced him. Because women could do that in ancient Rome. She divorced him. Well, he's enraged by this. And when he couldn't prosecute her, because she had every right to divorce him, he turned on a Christian by the name of Ptolemy, who influenced her toward Christianity. And he went after this guy instead, took it out on him. He was the scapegoat. And this Ptolemy was put under judicial interrogation to face one question only: are you a Christian? And he says, yes, I am. And he was executed. Now, two other Christians after that spoke up at the injustice of that condemnation simply for being a Christian with no other wrongdoing alleged, and they too were delivered over to execution. Justin tells that story. But that shows how in families, when you have this disruption, you want to get at somebody, you can use the Christianity as a way of getting to them. Now, he didn't really prosecute his wife for that, but he hurt somebody close to her, and that felt good, I guess. Another major concern for non-Christians was the apparent atheism of Christians. That bothered people. And I told you a little bit about that earlier. But popular understanding held that the gods needed visible representation. And when you worship an invisible god and you have no idols in your house, that's basically the worship of no god at all. And it was considered impious, right? Disrespectful to the gods. And why was it so, you know, who cares? It's individuals, what they want to do. What do you care? But there's a sense of solidarity here. social solidarity, the need for society to behave in a way that will keep the divine powers happy. Because the gods control all the events in the world. So as a group, we need to worship them properly. And you're not going along with the group. The world of that time desperately needed power, power for a regular supply of food. Famine was very common during this century. Health was a problem during the century. There were diseases and plagues that were running rampant. They needed peace. Civil wars were not uncommon, and also barbarians were threatening the edges of the empire. So where do you get that power? From the gods. They have to help you. Now, if you honor them appropriately, then they're going to maintain the good order of the world. But you have to have a good, harmonious relationship between you and the gods, between society and the gods. And the disloyalty of the Christians is imperiling the peace and health and prosperity of society. The fact that the Christians wouldn't sacrifice was a big problem. Now, this was a bigger problem than for the Jews, because at least they did, or at least used to have, a sacrificial system. The Jews didn't sacrifice to the gods, but they would offer a sacrifice on behalf of the emperor when they still had the temple. Christians, however, wouldn't sacrifice at all. They said that the sacrifice of Christ superseded all other sacrifices. And so, no, we're not going to do it. But sacrifice was fundamental to Mediterranean religion. So they viewed the Christians as pig-headed, jeopardizers of society. If they would only show some tolerance and appropriate respect for the gods, then maybe we wouldn't persecute you. All right? Just open up a little bit. Be a little flexible. Don't be so stiff-necked. And not only did the Christians cause offense by failing to sacrifice, but they openly broke with society and provocatively repudiated those religious obligations they were supposed to have and say it's from Satan, it's from the devil. So they're a threat to the well-being of the state. Emperors were never free of the possibility of a coup. It happened all the time. It happened in this century more than any other century where emperors were assassinated. So they're always nervous about permitting groups to exist that might turn out to be subversive. Early in the second century, for example, the Emperor Trajan was sufficiently jumpy to forbid the firemen of the city to form a volunteer society. He didn't like that. He goes, you know, what if they turn into some society that wants to come against me? So in that kind of climate, unsanctioned Christian meetings would appear to be risky to the state. They had to operate in a semi-underground fashion because they were worried about persecution. It kind of just feeds itself, so they hide away more. And that even makes the Romans not like them more because they're like, what are you doing in those secret meetings anyway? Okay. There also was a significant amount of cohesion and solidarity in the church itself. Cohesive organization with a huge social program. They took care of their own. It is said that in the 250s, in the city of Rome, there were more than 1,500 widows and other distressed persons who were on church support. Now, you can see why maybe someone on the outside might be a little worried about that. Like, there's this group, they're taking care of each other. They can operate and exist and function well, hardly without our help. That would be threatening to them. So, at the beginning, persecution largely resulted from popular prejudice, but now it's becoming an issue of the state's well-being, and in this century when things are going poorly for the state, even more so. So this leads us into the Decian persecution. Named after the emperor, Decius, sometimes pronounced Decius, D-E-C-I-U-S, he only ruled for 2 years, fortunately for the Christians. The emperors in the middle of the 3rd century are called the barracks emperors. That's a label for a bunch of emperors who were from the military. 26 soldier emperors in this period. Between 235 and 285, 26 soldier emperors. Many of them lasted only a few months and most of them died violent deaths because they were assassinated and somebody else took over. Okay. It's a very unstable government right now. And another characteristic of the third century was the declining economy. Coins were becoming progressively worthless until it reached a point where the government wouldn't even allow people to use money to pay taxes. The government agencies tended to instead confiscate goods and commandeer services from helpless Romans. The barbarian population pressure began to concentrate along the Rhine and Danube rivers in the second century, and it got worse in the third. The barbarians were adopting more advanced agricultural techniques, and they were trading ideas and trinkets with enterprising Roman traders. Politically, they began to consolidate in what were tribal confederations, and these are forerunners of states. Okay, very scary from a Roman point of view when you've got these states starting to form on the outside of the empire. As the barbarians continued to grow stronger, they were able to, during the third century, get past the defensive borders of the Romans. And several small hordes of barbarians would go around pillaging in Gaul and in the Balkans and in Turkey. That was a problem too. All of this is feeding that feeling of the gods are abandoning us, and we've got to do something about it. Eusebius, in his history, talks about how there were some persecutions popping up just prior to the Decian persecution, particularly in cities like Alexandria and Antioch. They had a very large concentration of Christians there. So the people were getting upset with them, the mob. He says that it had been going on for a whole year before Decius even became emperor, kind of a mass hysteria. It is said that there was Eusebius mentions that there was some kind of a prophet that appeared in Alexandria and stirred up the crowd against the Christians, and they just started thirsting for Christian blood and started going after them, and the authorities weren't really doing anything about it. But then Decius jumps on the bandwagon here, and he actually encourages even more. The actual text of his edict doesn't survive, but we believe it was issued early in his very short reign, and when the edict finally arrived, the authorities in Alexandria seemed to have employed it to actually amplify the persecution that was going on already and to legitimize it. Decius decreed that every Roman citizen must worship the Roman gods, including the deified emperors, during the month of the emperor's birthday. Everybody had to. And local officers, probably priests, pagan priests, were authorized to issue affidavits of compliance to those who obey the order. You get this certificate and it says that you did it. And then if anyone asks you, you can show them the paper and you'd be off the hook. All right. Some of these affidavits have survived, by the way. Sometimes they contain personal testimonies written out by the actual worshiper himself, if he's literate. Others, the ones who are illiterate, the government officials would write it out for them and they would just put an X on it or whatever. Initially, the command is to do it during the month of his birthday, and then you'd get a paper for that, and that would be good. That would last you for the year. Okay? But they started doing it all the time. They started doing it like, okay, well, things are still not getting any better, and he's going to be going into battle soon. We want to win, so they had him do it more, not just on the month of his birthday. But this is important, not just as far as Christianity is concerned, but religion in general, because it's the first time that the state is telling all of the citizens of the empire how to worship. They had complete religious freedom before this. Not so much anymore. Okay? So it's the first step in limiting religious freedom. It was a kind of a clumsy operation, but if you were discovered with no affidavit in your possession, you'd either be imprisoned or dragged into court to offer a sacrifice. Now, Decius' edict may not have been targeted specifically at Christians. It was just trying to get everybody to worship the gods properly so that things would start going better. But the Christians obviously would not have done anything, or they weren't supposed to, and so they would get a lot of attention. If you refuse to worship when you were commanded to do so, that's a huge, that's an act of treason. All right. We know that the Bishop of Rome early in 250 and several of his deacons were executed for not sacrificing. By the end of Decius' reign, it was enacted throughout the entire empire. So this is actually the first empire-wide, state-sponsored persecution of Christians. A number of them were thrown into prison. For example, Origen was. Decius ends up getting killed in battle against Germanic barbarians, and when he died, it stopped. Okay, and so the Christians could come out of hiding again. There were a number of Christians who forged affidavits so that they wrote it out themselves and say, oh, see, I sacrificed, to get out of it. There were others who purchased them from enterprising officials. But a number of them, under the intense pressure, went through the motions of sacrifice as they were commanded to do. Some, including the Bishop of Smyrna, actually became practicing pagans. All right. But many of those who did sacrifice, after the persecution was over, they wanted to get back into the church. And we'll talk about the problem of that coming up. Now, the Valerian persecution, named after the Emperor Valerian. He ruled from 254 to 259, but the persecution was just kind of... Actually, why did I put 260? I think it might have lasted a year after his death. Either that or I got the years wrong. Anyway, close enough. He experimented with another measure that was intended to guarantee the loyalty of the citizens of Rome. He ordered that the executive officers of all organizations had to represent their membership by worshiping the Roman gods as an expression of loyalty to the state. So it's a little hard to get everybody to do it. A little impractical. So why don't you just get the leaders of all the various organizations to do it on behalf of their members? Well, who would that be for the Christian church? The bishops. So a number of bishops were brought in. In the year 257 this was. And they wouldn't do it. A number of them went. Most bishops, because they're leaders, they pretty much are not going to lapse, although some did. But the bishops didn't comply, quite a number of them, and they were exiled, not executed. But any assembly of that organization was not allowed to meet. There wasn't allowed to be any worship, any funerals, marriages, nothing from that bishop's organization if he did not comply. If he complied, then the church could continue to meet. So it's another attempt to mandate religious behavior without regard for Rome's long-standing policy of religious freedom. If a congregation, by the way, tried to meet secretly and they were found out, they would all be arrested. We never find out what Valerian's original intentions were in dealing with the majority of the people he had in prison, because there was an invasion of the Sassanid Persians that distracted him. He found his treasury empty and he had to go to war, and he needed some money. So what he started doing was confiscating the property of any prohibited church. In other words, the bishop doesn't sacrifice. Now that church is prohibited, you can take their stuff. And that's what he did. And he confiscated all their wealth. And he used that to fund his military enterprise. Many Christians who were prohibited now from worshiping, if they were wealthy, he even went after them simply because they were wealthy. All right, even if they didn't even have a position of leadership in the church, but hey, you're a Christian and you're disloyal and you're not even allowed to have your organization anymore. He would confiscate these wealthy people's land. Just take it right away from them, and then he would send them into slavery. So that happened to a number of wealthy Christians. All imperial employees who were Christians had their possessions confiscated as well, and they also were sold into slavery. In 258, Bishop Sixtus II of the Roman Church was executed, and a number of his deacons. And Rome would actually not have any church there in the city for the next couple years. I think between 258 and 260, there is no church in Rome. It's estimated that at least 1,000 well-known Christians were executed in the Valerian persecution, but probably even many times that number were either banished or sold as slaves or just thrown into prison. All right. Valerian finally got enough money for his war, marched into Persian territory, and was promptly captured as a prisoner of war, and that was the end of him. When his colleague and successor, Gallienus, became the next emperor, he rescinded the order and restored religious freedom. He even gave back the churches their property, and further ruled that churches were now legitimate property-holding corporations. Now, ruined families were not always given their land back. He didn't do it for everybody, but he did give back the land back to the churches. If a church is now a legitimate corporation, as seems to be recognized now, they are able, the Christian officials, are able to appeal court cases all the way up to the emperor if they wanted, legally. So that was a step forward for them. Impact on the church. So during these first few centuries, society is rejecting the church, and the church in turn is rejecting society, and this is impregnating the church with a very sect-type mentality. The world is hostile, it's an evil place, it's a place of the devil. For Christians, it was us against the world. That kind of viewpoint fostered thinking like that advocated by Tertullian, where, you know, he said Christians have to avoid all of the, you know, elements of the evil world, like going to the gladiatorial contests or chariot races or athletic competitions. Anything that has to do with the rest of the world, you don't want to be involved in it. That thinking also shaped the theology of the church. And what's happening is, in contrast to what we saw in the first half of the third century, in the second half of the third century, there is a move away from philosophical speculation toward directly biblical thought forms, okay? Much simpler. In fact, Tertullian, you know, he just railed against philosophy, and his way of thinking actually becomes popular during the latter half of the third century. Here's something that he once said. What has Athens to do with Jerusalem? What concord is there between the academy and the church? What between heretics and Christians? Our instruction comes from the porch of Solomon, who had himself taught that the Lord should be sought in simplicity of heart. Away with all attempts to produce a Stoic, Platonic, and dialectic composition. We want no curious disputation after possessing Christ Jesus, no inquisition after enjoying the gospel. With our faith, we desire no further belief. For this is our primary faith, that there is nothing which we ought to believe besides. Well, those views were widely accepted, particularly as a result of the persecution. The more the world is hurting you, the more you don't want to be anything like them. Okay? So that is what is happening. The ongoing threat of martyrdom made becoming a Christian a risky business. You had to think twice about joining now. If you know, like you're on the outside, you're interested in Christianity, but you see people getting killed, it's not going to make you really want to become one, right? So conversion probably took greater commitment than it had previously. Now that's going to become much less the case in the next century. In the fourth century, we're going to find people, it's convenient to be a Christian, so they're going to get tons of people converting. But during this period, uh-uh. Persecution and martyrdom may have been a barrier to the growth, not just because of the stigma and the peril of death, but the church had to become careful about who they allowed into their meetings. There could be spies, right? They were worried about spies coming in and revealing what they were doing there. And so the one work I told you about, the Didascalia Apostolorum, remember that one? That suggests that only the repentant were allowed in a Christian gathering. And another work from a little bit later, suggests that a deacon is to be kind of a church bouncer. He's supposed to stand at the door, and if anyone comes in that he doesn't recognize and he thinks could be a threat, he wasn't allowed to let him in. Now, that's funny because, ironically, Tertullian thinks that persecution and martyrdom is actually going to feed church growth. And he says things like, oh, well, when you see, people standing up for their faith, they're just going to admire it so much, and that's going to make you want to be a Christian. I mean, it happened with some people. Justin Martyr became a Christian that way. But I don't know how many people would actually respond in that way. We don't think that too large of a converting role should be ascribed to martyrdoms. But another legacy of the persecutions was a strengthened sense of linkage with the past. What they started doing was celebrating martyrs' days, the anniversaries of famous martyrs, the day that they died. They would hold ceremonies at their burial places. They would treasure relics from these people. Do you know what a relic is? Yeah, it's a part of the martyr's body. Okay? That people would hold on to as kind of a special, having some kind of supernatural protective powers or something like that. Relics became important. They would pray sometimes to the martyrs for assistance. But that gave the church a sense of solidarity with past generations, the past people who died for the faith. But that leads into our next topic here, the prizing of Christian martyrdom. Jesus' death provided an example for other Christians. He was the great exemplar. To follow him into death meant that you were, this is like the ultimate in Christian perfection. Now, the basic call for Christians was to be a faithful witness of the gospel. The word martyr actually means witness. But already, even as early as the book of Revelation, the true witness, the best kind of witness, is one that's going to be martyred, killed for their faith. All right? From that thinking, the role of the martyrs came to be based more on their death than on their testimony. And very early, martyrdom became a prize state for some Christians. Look at Ignatius. He actually used the expression lusting for death. Okay? Here's what he says, Ignatius. Permit me to become food for the wild beasts through whose instrumentality it will be granted me to attain to God. I am the wheat of God, and let me be ground by the teeth of the wild beasts that I may be found the pure bread of Christ. Let fire in the cross, let the crowds of wild beasts, let tearings, breakings, and dislocations of bones, let cutting off of members, let shatterings of the whole body, and let all the dreadful torments of the devil come upon me. Only let me gain Jesus Christ. So he's saying, bring it on, I want it. Okay? It's interesting. It's not just like, well, I got caught, I'm arrested, I'm going to stick up for my principles. It's almost like, yeah, baby, come on, kill me. All right? In 185 CE, a number of Christians actually courted death by presenting themselves before the proconsul of the province of Asia. They actually went to him and turned themselves in, just so they could be martyred. And he killed a few of them, and then they were all just lining up, kill me, kill me. And he says to them, you wretched men, if you wish to die, you have your own cliffs. You have your own nooses. Go jump off them or hang yourself. And he made them leave. Okay? Now, not all Christians were into that, but some really thought it was a great thing. But some people spoke out against it. Clement of Alexandria, for example, he spoke out against courting death. He says it's suicide, and suicide's wrong. He mentions about the original meaning of the word martyr, how it's a witness, and that's really what's the important thing. But still, for most Christians, especially by this time period, it was probably death for Christ that that was the more praiseworthy focus. And in church understanding, the notion began to develop that only martyrs had immediate access to heaven. And it's based on a passage in Revelation chapter 20. Okay? All non-martyrs, people thought, would go to Hades to await their salvation. But if you died in the arena, you'd go right to heaven. Okay? So it's better to die that way. It's a fast pass. The notion of a fiery hell, you know, where you burn forever in torment, some people do believe in it already. But when I mentioned Hades here, I mention it more as a place where it's kind of like a holding pen. It's more like the Greek Hades, where you're kind of in limbo. It's not really a place of punishment. It's just a place where dead people go. Okay, and then you see what will happen when you're resurrected. You go to heaven. Okay. Martyrdom also gained importance as a substitute for baptism. And I told you this before, right? When I talk about baptism, how when you die in the arena, you're being baptized by your own blood. Okay? So there are a lot of catechumens that actually got martyred. But it was okay, because that was their baptism when they died. They were getting baptized in their blood. Martyrdom also was seen as potent, not just for the victim, but also for those around him or her. Origen actually compared the efficacy of martyrdom with the death of Jesus. He says, "Baptism in the form of martyrdom, as received by the Savior, is a purgation for the world. So too, when we receive it, it becomes a purgation for many." He says, "Perhaps just as we have been purchased by the precious blood of Jesus when Jesus received the name that is above every name, so some will be purchased by the precious blood of the martyrs, for they themselves are exalted higher than they would have been if they had only been justified and not also become martyrs." That's quite a statement. No wonder that a cult of martyrdom quickly sprang up, and this is what we're going to find. I told you about martyrs' days being celebrated each year. They started singing hymns to martyrs. There was a prizing of relics. There's a story that the body of Polycarp was deliberately burnt by the Jews to prevent a cult being built around it. That's a later legend about him, but it shows you the value of the relics. And also, as immediate travelers to paradise, the martyrs became a point of contact between heaven and earth. So the Christians believed of them as having intercessory power. We find graffiti scratched on walls near martyrs' graves with prayers like, "Peter and Paul, pray for Victor," and "Lord Crescentio, heal my eyes for me." Peter and Paul may be the apostles, but they believe they could be names of martyrs. Lord Crescentio is apparently a martyr. He can heal a person. Okay, he's praying for healing. Now, there are also what we call confessors. A confessor is somebody who was brought before the authorities and confessed to being a Christian, but ended up not being executed. Maybe they were thrown in prison and they were tortured or whatever, but they didn't die. All right? So they are still around. Strictly speaking, they're not martyrs, but confessors were credited with access to God that other people didn't have, similar to the access that the martyrs have, except they're still on earth. Because they were perceived as being close to God, people kind of drew around them. Tertullian spoke of queues thronging prisons where confessors were, and he says, "No sooner has anyone put on bonds than adulterers beset him, fornicators gain access, prayers echo round him, pools of tears from sinners soak him." He's saying that, you know, if somebody's thrown in a prison, people go visit him. He says, sinners go visit him. And they're like, could you pray for me? You know, ask God for forgiveness for me, and so on and so forth. Asking the confessor for some kind of intercession. All right. This led to a situation where confessors took to themselves the right to forgive sins and restore certain people to communion in the church apart from the church leaders. And the church leaders did not like that at all. Now, I had you read a work called The Martyrdom of Perpetua and Felicitas. Now, it's from a little bit earlier than this time, but it's perfect for this topic. It tells you about how people viewed martyrdom. The historical context is in the early 200s. It was written about 203. Persecutions were breaking out in North Africa. Between about 202 and 206, there were persecutions there. And the process at the time was surveillance, detainment with an opportunity to forswear your beliefs, prison, trial, sentence, martyrdom. But the targets were primarily catechumens, and that's who Perpetua and Felicitas are. They're newly interested people. They haven't even been baptized yet, although Perpetua and Felicitas get baptized in the story. But there's a gender factor here. Women are often depicted as being especially ardent believers who set examples for the men in their family, and that's exactly what you see in this story. One of the ways for women to gain social status was to die a martyr's death. In Perpetua's family, she and a brother were both catechumens, but the rest were not Christians. They may have been Christian sympathizers, but they weren't Christians. A whole story is written about her, and now she's important for the church. That's her, by the way, on the right, Perpetua. The martyrdom of Perpetua is loaded with all kinds of Montanist themes and theology, which tells us that it probably was written by a Montanist. Although, I'm talking about the beginning and the end. The way it's structured, the introduction and the conclusion are third-person narratives, probably by a Montanist, and some people think it was Tertullian himself who wrote it. And then there's the middle part, which is actual first-person narratives by Perpetua and Saturis. Okay? And we think that probably Perpetua actually wrote that part, although we don't know if she was a Montanist. All right? But notice the interesting beginning to this story. You can kind of see the Montanist themes. He says, "If ancient examples of faith kept, both testifying the grace of God and working the edification of man, have to this end been set in writing, that by their reading, as though by the showing of the deeds again, God may be glorified and man strengthened, why should not new witnesses also be so set forth, which likewise serve either end?" So he's basically crafting this, so why should you accept this account? But notice how he's mentioning, if past deeds of famous people are, you know, held up as great writings, why not new ones? All right? And there doesn't seem, you know, he's talking about canonical accounts, like the great stories of what happened to even Jesus and the early apostles. But why not have new stories, too? But he takes it one step further. He says, "Yea, for these things also shall at some time be ancient and necessary to our sons. Though in their own present time, through some reverence of antiquity presumed, they are made of but slight account." So, you know, they're not thought of that great today, but they will be one day. "But let those take heed who judge the one power of the Holy Spirit according to the succession of times, whereas those things which are later ought for their very lateness to be thought the more eminent according to the abundance of grace appointed for the last periods of time." And then he gives a prophecy about in the last days, God's going to pour out His Spirit and people will prophesy. That's a Montanist idea. New prophecy. Okay? He's talking about new prophecy. And then he says, "We also, therefore, by whom both the prophecies and the new visions promised are received and honored, and by whom those other wonders of the Holy Spirit are assigned unto the service of the church, to which also was sent the same Spirit, administering all gifts among all men, according as the Lord hath distributed unto each, do of necessity both write them and by reading celebrate them to the glory of God." Right? He's clearly saying, you know, the Spirit is revealing new things to us. And you see it again at the end. He says that these new wonders also may testify that one and the same Holy Spirit works ever until now. Meaning, just as the Holy Spirit worked on the apostles and the early followers, they work on us now. There's no difference. They prophesied, we prophesied. Okay? It's important still. There's no closing of that page in Christian history. That's a Montanist idea. He even assumes that the new stories are even more valuable than the old. Okay? Now, beyond the mountainous themes, we find other things in here directly related to martyrdom, for example. Among them, suffering after death and prayer for the dead. Now, what do I mean by that? The suffering of the dead is seen in Perpetua's vision of her dead brother, Dinocrates. He's suffering in the afterlife because he was not a Christian. And he's suffering in the afterlife. And she prays for him. A Christian who prays, a live Christian, can pray for a dead person who was not a Christian so that their condition in the afterlife will improve. So that belief is expressed there. Okay? There's also an emphasis on individual responsibility for following the path of salvation. It's a very non-corporate here. It's all about what Perpetua does as an individual. Okay? And even the death itself is an individual decision. Does anyone notice what happens when there's a soldier who's about to stab her with his sword and he hesitates because he feels bad about it or something? What does she do? She takes his sword and helps him stab her. That's borderline suicide, right? But it's almost like, I don't die unless I decide I'm going to die, you know. And same thing happens with Saturus. It says that he died of his own accord. Okay. And actually, the narrator says, it was as though so great a woman, feared as she was by the unclean spirit, could not be dispatched unless she herself were willing. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that all Christians thought this way, but certainly the writer does. There's also an emphasis on renouncing her former way of life. Apparently, she was an upstanding Roman citizen. Okay? She had a good family. She had a good upbringing. But she rejects all that. There's even a part in there where her father's pleading with her to reject Christianity. I'm sorry, Father. She has a baby. She just had a baby. And she's talking about how initially she missed her baby, but then when she realized she's doing the right thing, she didn't miss her baby at all. And she goes to her death. Okay? And this is held up as, wow, wasn't she great? Now I'm going to tell you about the catacombs. And this is not for grooming your cat. All right. Oh, here's a painting, 1883. I thought it was kind of interesting, depicting the martyrs in the Colosseum. But again, it's a late, late painting. But it was such a magnificent painting, I had to show it. The catacombs. The ancient catacombs are one of the most interesting sites in ancient Rome, or in Rome today, actually. You can go into some of them. As a matter of fact, for the people that are going with me next summer to Italy, we're going to go to Rome. I'm going to make sure we can go see the catacombs. That will be awesome. But they form an underground maze in the outskirts of the city, and they provide some rare glimpses into the early centuries of Christianity. Besides there being burial chambers that line these tunnels, they also have all kinds of Christian art in them. The burial custom of most ancient Romans was cremation. You just store your ashes in an urn. But Christian belief in a bodily resurrection led some early Christians to reject that practice and bury their dead whole, their whole body, instead. Okay? I guess they felt like, well, if I burnt myself, then God wouldn't be able to put me back together. But anyway, the catacombs offer a solution to the space problem. There was a big space problem in Rome. Where are you going? You know, there aren't that many cemeteries that can hold a lot of people, and there's all kinds of people dying. That's why they cremated a lot of them. So where are you going to bury them? Well, you can find some space underground. They're also an ideal way to strengthen the sense of Christian community because all the Christian dead are buried together. And also, you can display your Christian symbols down there and perform Christian ceremonies without, you know, all the Romans watching you and getting upset about it. The first large-scale catacombs were made in the 2nd century, and they were all located outside the walls of the city because Roman law forbade burial within the city limits. In addition to burial, they were used for celebrating the anniversaries of the martyrs. many of whom were buried there. Many modern depictions of the catacombs show them as hiding places for the Christians while during periods of persecution. That probably occurred only in exceptional cases. All right? It's not, I mean, maybe some people hid there a couple of times, but that's really not the purpose of the catacombs. After Christianity becomes the religion of the empire, which is going to be in another 100 years, the cult of relics became an established part of Christian worship, and the catacombs became a place of pilgrimage. And then, within a couple more centuries, the saints began to be buried in churches rather than in catacombs, and then so they didn't really use the catacombs anymore. All right. There are 40 known underground cemeteries in Rome, and they're built along ancient Roman roads. Some of them are quite big. Inside, it's kind of cramped, but there's just so many of them in there. The early Christians bound the bodies of their dead in linen and placed them in these niches. You see them? These niches there? That's where they stuck the bodies. Wealthier families were able to construct larger cubicles that had ceilings and walls decorated with frescoes. And those frescoes are what are of interest to us. But let me show you a couple of the catacombs. This is a catacomb. In Italian, it's called the Catacomb of San Callisto, but that's St. Callistus. Remember Callistus? Told you about him before? He was the bishop of Rome in the early 200s, from 217 to 222 to be exact. He actually was not buried here. That's not why it's called that. It's called that because he oversaw the expansion and administration of this catacomb. Further expansion took place under the bishop Damasus, and I'll tell you about him later. He lived in the 300s. And then they started building things above the ground over this complex as well, especially in the 5th century. Anyway, the most famous part of the catacomb of Callistus is the Crypt of the Popes, as it's called now. And it has an inscription by Bishop Damasus with some early Christian graffiti. And it's got all kinds of interesting representations of baptism and the Eucharist. But I don't really have that up there. What you see there is, on the right, that's Jesus. Okay? And on, I'm not sure what the pot is. But on in the middle, bottom, you see, does anyone know what that is? It's kind of hard to tell. It's a fish with a basket of bread, loaves. There's a story in the Gospels where Jesus feeds everyone with the fish and the loaves. And then on the left, does anyone know what that symbol is? Bottom left? The bottom left. The bottom left. But that is the Good Shepherd on the right. Yes, Jesus as the shepherd. But on the left, what's on the left? Do you know that? Greek. Yes. It's called the Cairo. It's an early Christian symbol. Okay? It's the two first letters of his name. It's actually he, but Chi and Ro. Okay? For Christ. And that's a symbol that was commonly used to represent Jesus' name. Okay? Here we have some other interesting artwork. The Catacomb of Sebastian was founded in the 3rd century. It's dug out of a rock quarry, and it was actually given the description in catacumbus, meaning the sunken valley, and that's where the name catacomb comes from that particular site, and now they all get called catacombs. It's the only underground cemetery to be maintained after ancient times. They continued to use the Catacomb of Sebastian for quite some time. The Catacomb of Domitilla is named after a woman. Now, how does that come to be? She's actually a member of the Roman imperial family, was not a Christian. The catacomb doesn't even date from her lifetime. It was her descendants who built a series of catacombs, and they weren't even Christian, but they gave the catacombs to the Christians, who then used them, and her name just was still attached to it. Okay? That's how her name got to be on it. There were famous martyrs that were buried in this one, and that picture of the Good Shepherd, Jesus as a shepherd, is the earliest representation of Jesus as the Good Shepherd. Okay, earlier than the other one. And then the Catacomb of Comadilla, that's also named after a woman. She appears to have been the owner of the land upon which the in which the catacomb was built. And that's a late, that's is from a little bit later, and that's a, I think it's from the next century, and that's a depiction of Jesus with a halo. Okay. He almost looks like the traditional Jesus there, doesn't he? All right. I guess that's all I want to say about catacombs. Any questions on that?
Were they co-ed?
Yes, they were co-ed. All right. All right. Yeah, even a husband and wife might be buried next to each other and so on. You know. Penance. Baptism, as you know, was seen as a rite that accomplished cleansing from sin. But what happens if you sinned after you got baptized? And, you know, does it also depend on what kind of sin you perform? If you can perform a little sin, that probably you can probably let go for that. But what if you commit a big one? And what makes a big sin or a little sin serious or not so serious? Okay? The church seemed to allow for lesser sins to be dealt with through just personal confession, prayer, giving of alms, other acts of love. But what about the biggies? You couldn't be baptized again to cleanse yourself again. So this issue vexed the church for several centuries. The eventual solution was to have a solemn public process that we now call penance. It was, in the words of Tertullian, a second reserve of aid against hell. But the danger here is that if Christians, you know, rely on penance, knowing that, well, if I commit sins, I could always do penance, it would be like, well, that's going to encourage people to sin. So some people decided that maybe the best thing to do was to offer it only once. Okay, you get baptized, you get one more chance, you know, penance, one time you can do for a big sin, but that's all you get. Okay? And they were even, some people even suggested, don't even tell the baptized people that they could have penance. Just let them know later if they do something. Okay? And the earliest advocate of this idea appears to be a fellow by the name of Hermas, who lived in the second century. But Tertullian likes it too. He says, you can only do it once, never again. But he developed a theology of penance that some people will grasp onto, although not everybody. He felt that penance needed to be public, not private. Just like baptism is public, penance needs to be public. You need to confess your sins in front of everybody. All right? And you have a whole ritual with it, just like you do for baptism. He said you should take on the typical appearance of mourning, like when someone dies. So he recommends sackcloth. You wear sackcloth when you're in mourning and sitting in ashes. You eat plain food and drink. You groan. You weep. You make outcries. You prostrate yourself before the presbyters. You kneel before the congregation and beseech them to pray for you. And then you can get back in. Okay? Now, the issue comes up, though, for what sins do you have to do that? There's a lot of confusion about this. Are some sins are all sins forgivable? Can you do penance for all sins? Or are there some that are like automatically disqualify you? There seems to have been some distinctions they made between serious and not so serious sins, but not everyone agreed what they were. Tertullian said that all sins are remissible by the church except for three. Okay? He says they are murder, idolatry, you know, worshiping idols, and sexual sins like adultery, fornication. All right? Those three sins are unpardonable by the church. Now he says, now God might forgive you, but that's between you and God. As far as the church is concerned, we don't have the power to forgive those. He berated the Bishop of Rome for daring to offer to remit sins for adultery and fornication. Says that was ridiculous. All right? If a person does commit the big three, Tertullian said, they become excommunicated for life. And They're just left up to the mercy of God, but they're not allowed in the church. But not everyone agreed with him, as you can tell. He's ridiculing the Bishop of Rome for disagreeing with him, so it's not a widespread view, Tertullian's, although a number of people held it. In the aftermath of the outbreak of persecution, many regarded the confessors as having the authority to forgive sins. I told you that, right? So you have this problem when it comes to these sins. Someone who's an adulterer can say, well, I just talked to so-and-so who just was a confessor. They were thrown in prison and all that, and they forgave my sins. So I should be allowed in the church. And Tertullian and other bishops used to say things like, well, no, the final decision is with the clergy, not with the confessors. Okay, but since the confessors were forgiving people a little more freely than the clergy were, the clergy felt obligated to be more lenient. And so a lot of them allowed forgiveness for the big three. Okay. Toward the end of the 3rd century, a fellow by the name of Gregory Thaumaturgus identified 4 classes of penitents. He says there were weepers. They are people who stand outside the gate of the church begging for prayers. He says the second group is the waiters on the word, and they were allowed on the porch, but they had to leave prior to the Eucharist. He said there were submitters. They were allowed in the church, but they had to leave when the catechumens left, because the catechumens couldn't take communion. And then finally there were the restored, and they were the ones that were allowed back in totally. Now, this doesn't represent 4 degrees of sinfulness, but rather 4 stages that you had to go through in order to get back in the church. You started out as a weeper, then you worked your way up to a waiter, and then a submitter, and then to restored. Okay? And there were a certain number of years that you had to be each one. But depending on the church, each church had its own stipulations. Okay? Also, some churches lay down separate periods of excommunication for different types of offenses. So certain offenses had more years of having to do penance than others. But it was no light matter. Okay? Penitents actually had to wear distinctive garb that everyone knew, okay, who they were. They were subject to more fasts than the other people. It was very clear who was one of the penitents and who weren't. In some places, if you were in the process of penance, you were prohibited from sex, even if you were married, during the period of penance. And some of them even prohibited you from having sex ever again. Okay? They thought that you were more inclined to sins, and they have more restrictions on you. Some people, though, postponed their penance until they were on their deathbed, as you might guess, because you can only do it once, right? And this is the problem that people were having, like someone committed some adultery or whatever. Like, okay, well, I can do penance now, or I could do penance like when I'm dying, and I could do adultery all the time. Okay? And that's kind of what some people were doing. But, hey, getting your timing right is very important here, because if you play the winning card at the last minute, but when's the last minute? If you don't play that card, you lose everything. You go to hell. So, okay, there's a problem. But anyway, some people were doing that. Okay? You got to be back into communion with the church for... Yeah, so like... If you died while you're in the process of penance, well, then it's between you and God. They're not saying you're definitely not saved, but the church wasn't able to save you. It's up to God now. Okay? All right. So no test next time. It'll be next Tuesday. And we'll see you on Thursday.